This talk was recorded at the 2019 Actuarial Society of South Africa Convention at the Sandton Convention Centre. For more information on the Actuarial Society, visit actuarialsociety.org.za.
Good afternoon. Can we ask everybody to take your seats, please? Thank you. I'm Colin van Sail. I'm going to introduce our next speaker, Francois Marais. He's here to present on can the discrimination in risk underwriting in life insurance in the life insurance industry be ethically justified? So if that's not the session you wanted to attend, you still have some time to run out. Otherwise, please allow me to welcome our next speaker. Francois joined Sanlam in 1975, qualified in 1980, and he's a career Sanlam man. He did leave for a short while during his career to do a consulting stint. He said it was a bit of a midlife crisis, I mean. But then he returned back to Sanlam again. He's now retired. He's a father of three, happily married, and he keeps himself busy with Irish Terriers, Koi, and woodwork. And most importantly, with some studies. This year he completed his Master's in Applied Ethics in the very topic that he'll be presenting on today. So with that, please allow me to welcome Francois Marais. Thank you.
Well, good afternoon, everybody. This is really an intimidating venue. It's huge. Discrimination has actually become an ugly word in our society. When people almost by definition see discrimination as unfair discrimination against somebody, either on basis of sex or race or age or whatever. But the neutral meaning of discrimination is just to differentiate. And if you don't differentiate, if you don't discriminate correctly, you can actually be indiscriminate. But we have an act in South Africa called the Promotion of Equality and the Prevention of Unfair Discrimination Act of the year 2000. And what's interesting to note is that all the factors that we discriminate on in underwriting, with the exception of smoking, are on the red list of that act. And in terms of the act, if somebody complains against something that they see as unfair discrimination, then the respondent has got to prove that the discrimination is in fact not unfair and that it serves a legitimate purpose. That's what we are looking at now. If somebody should lay a complaint against an insurance company or against the insurance industry about our discrimination in our underwriting, can we actually prove that that is fair? Here we are. So the I can't read that. I'll have to look around. Agenda is short. We'll first look at the insurance side of things, and this you should all know very well, and look at the way and the extent to which you discriminate. Then we'll review the normative ethics theory of moral contractualism, which will be new to practically all of you, I suppose. And then we'll bring the ethics and the insurance together in the end and see what conclusions we can get to. So is the discrimination that we do in underwriting, is it actually unfair? Now, our typical actuarial answer to that will be, well, it's actuarial equity. Everybody should pay according to their risk. The high risk should pay more and the low risk should pay less, and that is fair. And then we will also justify the correctness, first argue that it's fair, and then we will justify the correctness of the discrimination on the grounds of our statistical evidence. And then we've got the economic justification on the other hand that says, well, we need it for the financial profitability of the insurance industry. And on a company level, that's true. If a specific company does not discriminate, does not give lower rates for non-smokers, he'll be selected against, and he won't be profitable. He won't be able to survive. On an industry level, the argument that the industry actually needs this for survival, that without discrimination we cannot have an industry, is a bit overrated. It is true for age. But for any of the other underwriting factors, it's not really true. The industry survived for 150 years only underwriting on the basis of age. I think if we look at the extent of the discrimination, you'll see that to actually justify that can be quite difficult. Most actuaries will be surprised. I was when I wrote the thesis. If we look at a premium of 100 rand, we'll buy about 20,000 rand worth of life cover for an old, low-income male smoker. It will typically be an uneducated person. Then for a mid-aged, midlife male smoker, slightly balding and expanding waist, typical, he can get 150,000 rand of cover for the same 100 rand premium. That's seven times more than the guy at the top. And then if you go to the next category, a young professional female non-smoker, you can almost add beautiful there, she can get 1 million rand of cover, which is again seven times more than the midlife male, and which is 50 times more than the poor old man. And this is really serious discrimination. And it actually goes against the second justice principle of the philosopher John Rawls, who says that if you do, if there is discrimination of distinction in the provision of social goods in a society, then it must be so as to favor or to benefit the least favored. And this is totally the opposite way around. So let us just look at insurance is not like any other commodity or any other product. It's really a unique product. You can't just buy in and it's like buying a car, say, pick a car and pay. You've got to be accepted to buy insurance. Now, the issues of risk pooling and cross-subsidies and adverse selection, we'll come to those later on again, work that in, but the question of information symmetry or dissymmetry between buyer and seller is the opposite way around in insurance. With a typical business, the dictum is caveat emptor, let the buyer beware, because the seller knows more about the product than the buyer. Typically, if you buy a second-hand car, you don't know about the problems that there's in the gearbox, but you must be beware. Whereas in insurance, it's the other way around. Here, the buyer has got more information about his own health situation, and here the dictum is utmost good faith. In the underwriting process, you must disclose all your health issues to the seller, who does not know about that. So the information symmetry is the other way around. And then on the issue of social good, this insurance is not just a normal commodity. And I believe that a basic level of insurance, a very basic level, say funeral cover type level, is really a primary social good, and we should regarded as a primary social good, and that means actually society as a whole should make sure that this is available to everybody. And we really need the National Social Security Fund, the NSSF, which has been gathering dust for 15 years now. We really need that, because this is a primary social good. Our commercial insurance is not really a primary, it would be a non-primary social good. It's not a plain commodity. It does have a specific social value. And as such, access to it can be important. So now if we look at insurance and the underwriting of insurance, you basically have two approaches to risk pooling. The one needing underwriting, and the other one does not needing underwriting. And you must understand both to be able to give comment on it. Now, on the one hand, we've got social solidarity for social security. And here, there's no underwriting. There is a huge cross-subsidy. All the young and healthy and rich subsidize the old and poor and sick on the other end of the scale. But it's okay, because membership is compulsory. Everybody's got to belong to this. You can't opt out, and you may be subsidizing the older guys now, but eventually you'll be subsidized by the younger guys following after you. And everybody has the same amount of cover. And here, the fairness principle is equality, not equity. We're all equal. But now if you come to mutual insurance, commercial insurance, which is where the risk pooling is on the basis of mutuality, then this is voluntary. You don't have to belong to the scheme, and you can choose how much cover you want. You can have 10,000, or you can have 10 million. And certainly, you can't have equality here. You have to underwrite, because nobody would like to cross-subsidize somebody with a million or 10 million life cover. He must pay for his own risk. And here, the full underwriting is absolutely essential, and the fairness is based on equality, on equity, and not equality. So, if we look at the underwriting criteria that we've used, and underwriting has been standard practice in the insurance industry for established practice for many decades, and the underwriting, but we get two kinds of underwriting criteria. First of all, there's the general underwriting criteria, which applies to everybody. We all categorized by your age, your sex, smoking habit, and your socioeconomic class. This applies across the board, so according to those criteria, you then allocate it to a specific risk group, and you get the standard rate for that risk group. Then on top of that, you can have the individual criteria of health and dangerous activities, part-time activities, and job and so on. They can also be unfair, I didn't consider them at all. I only looked at the general criteria affecting everybody, because this is definitely less than 10% of the population, but about 5% of applicants that are actually affected by the individual criteria. So the history of the underwriting criteria is actually quite interesting. Most of you under age 40, which seems to be most of you anyway, will not know a time where we didn't have all four of these underwriting criteria in insurance. I mean, you grew up with them. You may be surprised to know that when I joined the industry, we only had age and sex as underwriting criteria, and the others were added and followed afterwards, and I was can't claim responsibility, but I was involved in some of it. If we look at age, that was the main underwriting, or the only underwriting criteria from when insurance started in the 1800s till about 1950. Then, in the early 1960s, sex was added as a underwriting criteria, that's when I joined the industry. It was still a 3-year age deduction for male applicants, 3 years less than males, and that would typically be about it's a 5% difference per age. So it would be about a 15% discount for females. And that was then increased eventually to a 5-year discount in the 80s, and by the year 2000, it was a 7-year discount, which is equivalent to about a 35% discount. Now, this is a typical way of how a new underwriting factor is introduced. You have the suspicion that there's a group that has lighter mortality. And then you give them a small discount. Before, you don't really know and you can't really quantify it, but then you start, because you now differentiate, you start building up the statistics of the two different groups. And then in time you see, I was quite conservative, I can give more and more discount. That's how it goes. Then if you look at smoking status, this was introduced in the also in the 1980s. Now, here I can specifically remember at Sanlam, we decided we're going to lead the way, we're going to be innovative, and we're going to introduce non-smoker discount. And then some bright spark said, and we were far down down the road of implementation, said, but what about our biggest single pension fund client, Rembrandt? The whole project was scanned right there, and we waited for I think it was Liberty and Mutual to be first, and then we softly followed suit. But then the socioeconomic discount underwriting, I think that is where we as a country, insurance industry in South Africa, is almost unique, and we tend to lead the way. We have this very sophisticated insurance industry, and we've got this very heterogeneous population. We started off with, I remember that well, we started off calling them, we've got your normal rates, and then we had the preferential rates, about a 25% discount for preferential rates. And that would typically be somebody with a university degree or whatever, and smokers. They're also included in that first distinction. And then by the 1990s, we had a three-tier normal rate, preferential rate, and super rates. And the super rates were about 35% cheaper than the normal rates. So slowly developing. If you look at where we are now, age... it's still the same, if you look, it's about 5% per each increment of age, but if you look from age 20 to age 60, it's a huge difference. The sex difference has increased to about 50%, 50% more cover for a female than for a male, which is now equal to about a 10% discount. And we don't have an age discount anymore. We have sophisticated enough to have separate rates nowadays. Smoking status, about 100% more. And so you can see it's 50% is not such a significant discount. 100% is double that, which the typical smoker rates are, or the non-smoker gets about 100% more cover than the smoker. And then if you look at the socioeconomic class, and that is really by far the most significant discounts or differentiation. And if you take the... Where's the laser? There we are. If you take the cheapest class one, it's the guy with no matric, then as soon as you get matric and a little bit of a high income, you get 100% more cover for the same premium. And if you have a three-year diploma and still a high income, 200% more cover and so on. And typically, most companies or many companies have a five-year distinction there. And if you then put that all together and you take the age difference and the sex difference and the smoking difference and the socioeconomic class, that in total, if you multiply all this together, it will give you that 50 times differentiation between the beautiful young girl and the poor old man. That is the part that you're all basically familiar with. Maybe you didn't realize the quite big the extent it was. Now you come to the second part is the ethics lecture, and this is where you must now make like the blonde, who was sort of staring intently at the Oros bottle, and then somebody asked her, "Why are you so staring so intently at the Oros bottle?" And she said, "No, it says here on the label, concentrate." This is the part where you must now concentrate, but I'll take it slow. The normative theory of moral contractualism that I've used as a lens to look at this problem is a very, very new theory. It's actually just sort of come of age, about 21 years old since the big book was written. And compared to the other normative ethics theories, if you look at virtue ethics, I mean, that's 2,500 years old. That's from the days of Plato. If you look at deontology, it's 250 years old. And if you look at utilitarianism, that's about 150 years old. So this is brand new, no wrinkles, young. And it was developed by a Harvard professor called Tom Scanlon. And in his seminal book, What We Owe to Each Other, he set out his theory in detail. This has been hailed as one of the most important books on moral philosophy in the 20th century, a magisterial book that will influence the direction of ethics for years to come, and equaling theories such as utilitarianism and deontology. So Scanlon didn't agree with the main ethical theory of utilitarianism, where the moral value of an act is only judged by its consequences. And utilitarianism says that it must increase, an act is good if it increases the total well-being of the population. And he didn't agree with that, and then he defined what is the whole moral contractualism centered around this definition of his, of the definition of moral wrongness. And this has been called the most famous sentence in the late 20th century moral philosophy, and here it is. This is the concentrate part. I'll read it while you concentrate. An act is wrong if its performance under the circumstances would be disallowed by any set of principles for the general regulation of behavior, to which no one could reasonably reject as a basis for informed, unforced general agreement. Now, that sentence is the contractual equivalent of the categorical imperative of Immanuel Kant in deontology and of the greatest happiness principle of John Mills in utilitarianism. But I'll give you the diluted version of that, the light version. An act is wrong if it can be disallowed by any principle that no one could reasonably reject. And that we can all more easily understand. He defines when an act is wrong, and the positive statement of that is you can really say that an act is right if you can supply sufficient reasons to justify it, if you can justify your actions. So Scanlon wrote this thick book, 500 pages, and core to the theory, the three notions, and I mean, this is now the short summary. This is like the guy who read War and Peace, and then they asked him, somebody said, what is this about? And he said, it's about Russia. So this is now the short summary of the book. There are three notions. Justifiability. Scanlon argues that we want to be able, the main motive for us, people wanting to do the right thing, wanting to do good, is that we want to be able to justify our actions to other people. And then to be able to do that, the second notion is the notion of reason. To justify your actions, you must be able to give adequate reason for that, sufficient adequate reasons. And then if you, on a specific issue, if you've got a body of reasons, then you actually get a principle that is a general conclusion based on sufficient reasons that could defeat any reasonable objection. So Scanlon says you must define principles and then on this basis and then live by these principles, and you can approach any problem in this way. So the beauty and the strength of contractualism is it's got this single definition of moral wrongness. An act is wrong if it would be disallowed by any principle no one could reasonably reject, but it hasn't got, it can accommodate a number of moral notions. It can actually accommodate the overall well-being, the happiness principle of utilitarianism. It can accommodate the duty and responsibility and respect for the individual of deontology and other moral reasons. So it's actually a very useful tool. I found it a very useful tool. And the challenge in this study was to be able to define principles of insurance underwriting that no one could reasonably reject. So that wasn't too hard, was it? that's the ethics lecture. Now we're on the third part of the agenda. Now to apply the theory to the problem. We must first look at the general underwriting in general. Can we justify making a distinction at all, making discriminate, before we look at the specific features of the discrimination? So the fair lottery principle was my attempt. In a lottery where each ticket has an equal chance to win, all tickets should cost the same. It would be unfair to charge different prices for different tickets. I mean, that is something that nobody can reject. That's a good reason. So if I have 10 tickets and you have one ticket in the lottery, then I should have paid 10 times more for my 10 tickets. Now, the same if it's in the death claim sweepstakes. If I have 10 tickets against your one ticket, then I must pay 10 times more for my policy and for my death risk than you with a much lower risk. The underlying assumption there, however, is that we actually know how many tickets each one holds. If you know exactly how many tickets each one holds, then that is fair to do so. The problem is in underwriting, in life insurance, we don't exactly know how much tickets each one holds. We don't exactly know exactly what your risk is. So we can justify the general principle of underwriting, but now we must look at the different underwriting factors. And the problem is that actuarial science is not an exact science. Actuarial risk writing and determining the the risk of each person. We don't know. We don't know it exactly. But what we do know is that if you just look at, if we just differentiate by age, and you've got all the 40 years old together as a group there, then we know now definitely, and we've got evidence, that if we would subdivide them by sex and by smoking habit, then we'd get a much clearer and much more correct picture. We'll improve the level of underwriting. We'll improve the correctness of the underwriting. So adding new underwriting factors is a good thing. We should be doing that, and we should be refining it as far as we can. Now we're at the point where we must say, okay, these underwriting factors that we are actually using, how can we justify them? And this is where I defined this very original name, the Fair Discrimination Principle. And I say here that an underwriting factor is justifiable. I've got three conditions. If it's strong and reliable statistical evidence, if there's reasonable causal explanation, and if there's unambiguous allocation to a risk group. Now, clearly, each one of their own, I think you will agree, is a necessary condition for fairness. If a criteria does not meet that condition, it cannot be fair. So it's a necessary condition. I think what is slightly more controversial in what I propose is that if you take these three conditions together, you get what I would see as a sufficient condition for fairness as well. And I'll be quite happy to accommodate suggestions for further criteria to be added there if you say this is not sufficient. But I think if we this is the definition or the principle that I've used to look at our underwriting factors. So what we're going to do now is we're going to take each of these criteria, look at it briefly, and then see how our age, sex, smoking, and socioeconomic class fare against these criteria. So first of all, you need strong and reliable evidence. Strong evidence means there must be a significant difference. I mean, a 5% difference is not significant, it's not strong enough. 100% difference or a 200% difference, that is significant, strong evidence. And then it must be reliable evidence. And for reliable evidence, you need adequate statistical evidence. You need a believable investigation. So if you look at age, and this is the original one, this is the one that we must be able to justify as fair, otherwise we don't have an industry. And if you look at the statistical evidence that we have there, it is huge. I think the latest, well, we've got the CMI, Continuous Mortality Investigation Subcommittee, and they do an investigation every 5 to 10 years. I think the latest one is vastly overdue. Is that not? I believe that maybe there's somebody in the committee there. I believe there's been some problems with it. But the last official one was based on 15 million policy years. This is the stats provided by all of us together, the whole industry, pooling our stats, and 80,000 deaths. This is serious evidence. So I think we can say that we have strong and reliable evidence. If you look at sex, again, that whole population can be divided into male and female, and about 40% female, 60% male, and we've got this binary binary distinction, male and female. We're not into the gender distinctions here. That means we've got 9 million male policy lives and 6 million female policy lives, which is against strong evidence. And the difference of 50% in mortality is sufficient enough to make it worthwhile. Then if you look at the smokers, now the stats get getting slightly thinner, but you've got 30% male smokers and 15% female smokers, which will still give you about 1 million female smokers. Can you believe that? Imagine 1 million ladies smoking. But it's still strong evidence. It's strong and reliable evidence, I think. And the difference is here. The difference is up to depending on the age. As you get older, the effect is larger. So strong and reliable evidence. And then the socioeconomic class. This is where it starts getting a bit dicey, but it still passes this test. We couldn't use about half of the data we couldn't use, or is not used in the CMI, because it's unspecified. So, and then it's subdivided into four different classes. So the stats is a slightly less per class, but the evidence is extremely strong. Strong evidence of big difference in mortality based on these groupings. So strong and reliable evidence, no problem there. The next criteria is you must have a reasonable causal explanation for the difference. Most scientific research is based on gathering data and making and getting correlation between variables and drawing conclusions from such correlations. But the saying that correlation is not causation, that correlation does not prove causation. So you can't, because there's a correlation, say this proves whatever is correlated with that. I believe there's a correlation between the number of births in Norway and the number of storks in summer there. And that doesn't prove the myth. The actual reason may be just the long winters that they have there, something like that. So you need to provide strong and reasonable causal explanation. So if you look at age, there's no problem. I mean, if you get older, like we all do, some of us more than others. It's like an old car. The spares that start getting problems and they have to be replaced, and later on you can't even get replacements for them. There's a very direct causal relationship between age and mortality. Between sex and mortality, it's wonderful, even this is not really a causal explanation, this is just a fact, that newborn in the first year of life, the male mortality is about 25% higher than female mortality. I don't think they know why, but it's a fact. But then as we grow older, we get a better explanation for the male mortality. It's basically stupidity. We work harder, we stress more, we smoke more, we drink more, drinking leads to road accidents, and we drive faster, we drive more. We're just not that sharp. Let's face it. The women are a superior species. They're better looking. They're smarter than us. And that's why we do all the heavy lifting. And in the end, they outlive us by 10 years. So I think the causal explanation there is sufficient. On the smoking side, there's overwhelming evidence that smoking causes disease, and that if you smoke long enough, you will most likely die because of some smoking-related disease. But this hasn't always been the case. if you go back into the 1950s, when you still see these ads by the tobacco companies of the beneficial value of smoking, of the health values of smoking, and there's this beautiful ad that said, the Camel ad that said, Camel is the brand most preferred by medical doctors. We've developed a little beyond that. And then if you look at socioeconomic class, again here, there's many studies that show that well-educated people have healthier lifestyles, which lead to better health and better mortality. And if you're wealthy on top of being healthy, you can afford this better lifestyle. And it's issues like better diet, better living conditions, better working conditions, better access to medical schemes and medical provision, doctors, and so there's a very strong or defendable causal explanation for the difference based on socioeconomic class. But then we come to the last criteria. This is the allocation to risk groups. The easy one is the age and sex. You just look at the ID book and see, you know, what is the age and what is the sex. It's easy to allocate them into the right group. There's this beautiful story of the head office sent out this memo to the branches and said they want a list of all the people working at the branch, neatly broken down by age and sex. So they get an answer back from this one branch in the northwest, and they said they've got this one gentleman who's quite old, and he's not that very healthy anymore. But they're happy to report they've got nobody broken down by sex. So, but if you look at smoking status, here again it's a binary distinction. Tell you you're a smoker or a non-smoker, and determine your premiums accordingly. This is not as clear as the age and sex one, because here we've got to rely on the the Burima Fides, the utmost good faith. You've got to trust the smoker or the non-smoker that says he's non-smoking. But we can send the non-smoker with the yellow teeth for a cotinine test to see whether he's been lying through his yellow teeth. But we tend to err on the safe side. A smoker, a guy who has smoked and who's quitted smoking and he passes the cotinine test, and maybe the damage is done, like Neil Young's song said. Those of you old enough to know Neil Young. But we tend to err on the safe side and give the quitted smokers the benefit of the doubt. But then if you come to the socioeconomic class, this is where it gets problematic. Because there's no common standard. There's no common standard in the industry of what the socioeconomic subdivision should be. Each insurer has got his own definition of education level and of income level, and income levels cannot stay the same forever. They've got to be adjusted occasionally for inflation. There's quite a lot of difficulty around the cutoff levels. If I'm a category or class 3, and the cutoff level for class 3 is 30,000 income, then if I'm just below that 29,000, I'm in class 3, and if I'm just over that in 31,000, I'm suddenly in class 4, which is a rather small income difference, and it gives me a 50% discount on the rate, which is huge. And this is difficult. This uncertain allocation into socioeconomic groups is a problem. And speaking of race, I mean, we also run the risk, because there's a big correlation in South Africa between income and race, that this can be seen, which is not, but this can be seen as a covert form of racial discrimination as well. So that is the only place in my analysis where I found that we really have a problem. So age, sex, and smoking, they meet the the criteria of being fair and justifiable. Socioeconomic class, strong evidence, very strong evidence, but less reliable data. There's a reasonable causal explanation, but the questionable allocation to risk group. So, in conclusion, I think it's difficult. I couldn't say that my analysis can be used to prove that socioeconomic underwriting is fair. But then we all know that the industry is unlikely to change. The industry can't change on its own. If you on the sex discrimination one, you all probably know that the EU. Everybody used to discriminate on the basis of sex, male and female, but the EU in 2012 issued a new regulation that outlawed sexual discrimination, and that is, and now this is always sort of the wrong way around. I mean, we used to discriminate in favour of the females. So this doesn't really make sense. I mean, they say you know, this is not unfair discrimination, but equality. So I'm not sure whether it was a bunch of males who took this decision, but equality is more important than giving them a discount. So I mean, I wouldn't have been happy with if I was a female. I'd rather pay less than being treated equal. But. The industry on its own wouldn't have changed, but if you get the regulation, then the industry changed. And at the time, there were big papers were written and actuaries were complaining about how this will affect the industry. It didn't affect the industry one bit. It was a smooth changeover. But the sex differentiation is rather small. It's only about a 50% difference in rates. So now women pay slightly more and men pay slightly less, and we're very happy about it. And the industry survived. Maybe after Brexit, Boris will try and do something to get the women on his side and say that we're going to go back to discrimination in favour of females, but let's wait and see. I think what one can possibly look at is a, if we want to address the problem, is to try and solve it with product development. First of all, I really think that we need a social security basic form of cover in the country. That will actually take away the class one in the socioeconomic distinction is we have the people without matric, and it will make the whole discrimination be less prominent than that. I think the insurance industry can also, rather than have discrete cut-off points, income levels, like four or five discrete income levels, have a continuous one, which will make the changes less. The problem at the border of the change less objectionable, or one can have a policy where everybody pays the same higher price for the first 50,000 rand of cover, and as your sum assured increases, you pay lower and lower rate, so that if you end up with paying for 1 million rand of cover, then you don't have to pay that much for the initial 50,000. So there will be ways around it. We can decide whether we want to do something about it or whether we're going to lie low and hope nobody complains about this, which has been going on for the last few decades. Maybe we're lucky. Maybe we survive. And I think then the last conclusion that I can draw from this, what I've learned out of this, is that the moral theory of contractualism is a very useful tool to try and resolve issues like this. I'd strongly recommend it. It's definitely much more useful than utilitarianism. And then we come to the last slide, which the speaker normally likes best, and quite often the audience as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Francois. So we've got time for a couple of questions. So if you can just raise your hand just to indicate if anybody has a question. We've got one question there at the back of the room. And we've got three hands up there and one hand to the right as well.
Hello. Hi, Francois. My name is Bjorn. I'm from Jazz. Firstly, I just want to commend you on the topic. It takes courage to unpack this and a good methodical analysis.
Thank you.
As you may know, we underwrite annuitants. So that, of course, means the risk is the opposite and the challenges may be too. Just want to hear your comments then, specifically on socioeconomic underwriting and some of the ethical questions you raised there for normal underwriting, whether you believe that applies to annuity underwriting too.
Annuity underwriting, oh, yeah. I suppose it does, that you should give better annuities to people with higher mortality risk. But in South Africa, whereas in this previous session that I attended, I was told that about 90% of annuities are living annuities, it's really not an issue. I mean, nobody actually buys guaranteed annuities anymore. So I don't think there'll be enough market pressure to actually introduce that distinction, and I don't think somebody who really wants to complain about that can just tell them, well, you don't have to take a living, or you don't have to buy a guaranteed annuity, you can take a living annuity. So I don't think it'll ever be an issue, even if it is unfair, slightly.
Rob Thompson. Thank you, Pancho. I'd like to take issue on a matter of reasonable causal explanation with regard to class. I think you gave the proximal causes, but you didn't explain how that those derive from class. For example, class, you define class in terms of education, which could reflect the wealth of your parents. And similarly, the wealth of the parents could be affecting the direct proximal causes that you listed, so that it's not directly causation. Both are caused by a prior effect. I don't know whether I'm making myself clear. So you've got three possible sources of causation. The one is education, what you call class. The second is the effects that you mentioned. And the third is something that is causing both lots of A and B, if you like. So it's not causal. The class concept is not causal. There's no causal, no necessary causal relationship between those effects.
I'm not sure that I quite understand the argument. Obviously there may be different factors at play as well, apart from income and education. I think even to say that the income and education are really strong causal effects is can also be pushing it. To prove that they do studies and they show correlation against between income and health issues. So it's very difficult. It is difficult to prove cause. So I think what I would suggest is that I think there can be a sufficiently strong argument made that there is actual It's not like the stalks in Norway. When you can bring up arguments in favor of saying that this is why there is a correlation between the cause and the effect. I've read papers that specifically look at the relationship between mortality and race. And the strong correlation in the one paper that I saw, but I can't even remember which country that was. It's in the US. But all the correlation was related again down to income, which is a much stronger factor than just saying, well, there's a correlation between race and mortality. So I don't think it's a 100% answer, but I think it's as good as it gets.
Sorry, we are out of time, so let's take one closing question, and then we'll have to break for refreshments.
Hi, Francois. John Davidge from Old Mutual. I think you can find another principle to add to your three that would strengthen your rejection of class as a fair discriminating factor. If you think about age and gender, people have no choice about their age and their gender, and it happens equally to everyone. You had a 50% chance of your gender, and age hits everyone at the same rate. Smoking is something that you choose, but overwhelmingly in South Africa, your class is something that has been imposed on you by a system, by someone else. And I think there's a principle there about choice that you can explore, that to say, because my class has been imposed on me, it's not fair to discriminate against me because of my class. And I think if you work something around there, you would be able to strengthen your rejection of class.
Thank you. Yeah, I agree with that. There's a paper that I read around about 1994, just at as democracy hit us. There was a SO committee which was instructed to look at this specific issue, and they brought in this issue of the factors that you can actually affect by like smoking, because you can choose to smoke or non-smoke, and therefore it's okay to discriminate, but if you don't, then they made the same point. I agree. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Francois. Please join me in thanking Francois for a very insightful talk, and clearly there was a lot of questions, so thanks for that as well. And just to add to that, I understand Francois is going to be doing another postgraduate diploma next year, so all the best for that. We hope that is just as successful. Thank you very much.